Okay, so thank you guys, everybody, for coming. I know it's been a weird couple of days, and it's winter, and a lot of people on vacation. And we didn't know that this freak beautiful day would happen. But it worked out well, although I hear there's a cold front coming in a few minutes, so we'll see what happens. We have the heat warmers, so we'll see how we're doing. As usual, so there are hamburgers. I just talked to them. They're on their way. As usual, this cost me this time about $160. So anything tips wise would be much appreciated. Even if you don't eat the food, because it still costs money to get this place. But today I'm going to be talking to you about Moby Dick, and my goal is actually this is Moby Dick. This is a picture book of Moby Dick. And my goal is actually to see if I can convince you to read it or reread it. And just out of curiosity, who has read Moby Dick? Three people. Three people? Well, I know Tora has read it, he said. Or kind of, okay. Wow, three people, not even in high school, anything like that. Interesting. Okay, so I'm going to tell you a little story. On November 1820, the American whaling ship, the Essex, was rammed by a sperm whale, causing it to sink. Most people know that the Essex is the origin or one of the inspirations for Moby Dick, but there's more to this story. As their ship was sinking, the crew of the Essex boarded their little boats and set out for land. Before them, they had two choices. One choice was to put their boats on a path toward an island not that far away that they knew to be full of cannibals. The other choice was to go over 3,000 miles of open sea to hopefully civilized port. They chose the sea and those civilized ports. In other words, not the cannibal island that was nearby. Over 100 days later, they were found. 8 out of the original 20 survivors were still alive. One report of these men states that one survivor clutched to his chest a human shin bone. In other words, as they fled Cannibal Island, they themselves became cannibals. Now, I think there's a lesson in there for all of us. And I think Herman Melville got a lesson out of that as well. By not facing head on our own ignorances and fears, we become that which we fear most. I believe all of us do this a little bit. We avoid facing truth about maybe, let's say, a bad relationship or out of fear, and thus we create a bad relationship. Out of fear caused by ignorance, we avoid to spend time or get to know certain people, places, events, jobs, relationships, and thus become the ignorant, fearful person we assume those people to be. For the crew of the Essex, the island of cannibals was their salvation. That's where they would have survived. We sometimes run from that which can be the very thing we most desperately need and end up drifting on an endless ocean only to become the worst version of ourselves. I've seen too many times to count someone run from a great relationship out of fear of and end up in that endless ocean only to regret it later in life. In other words, our fears and ignorances cause us to become cannibals metaphorically. We cannibalize ourselves and sometimes those around us. To quote from Moby Dick, "Cannibal, who is not a cannibal? I tell you, it will be more tolerable for the Fiji that salted down a lean missionary in his cellar against a coming famine. It will be more tolerable for that provident Fiji, I say, in the day of judgment than for these civilized and enlightened gourmands who nailest geese to the ground and feastest on their bloated livers in the pate de foie gras." Now, American adventurer, sailor, merchantman, whaler, and author Herman Melville heard the story of the Essex and he attempted to learn from that story. He, rather than avoid it, he wanted to learn it. When he had the choice, so he was actually a sailor and a merchantman and a whaling man. He was a harpooner in his youth. When he actually had the same exact choice as the Essex men, he chose to live among the cannibals. He actually lived among the cannibals. And this actually leads to one of my favorite quotes in Moby Dick, which is spoken by the fascinating narrator, Ishmael, when he says, "It is better to sleep with a sober cannibal than a drunken Christian." And I love that line. The first and probably most important reason to read Moby Dick is this exploration of universal human themes that are throughout this story, such as the quest for meaning in life, the nature of obsession, conflict between will and fate, struggle between man and nature, the role of friends, companionship, marriage in our lives, leadership, democracy, and so much more. Quoting Moby Dick again, "To produce a mighty book, you must choose a mighty theme. No great and enduring volume can be written on the flea, though many there be who have tried it." And so he wrote it on a whale. Moby Dick was published in 1851. It was a major flop, huge flop. For context, Melville, his first and biggest success was a novel called Typee. And Typee was based on his exploration of the cannibals and his time with the cannibals. And that novel, just for context, sold 16,000 copies in its first weekend. This is 1840s. That was a big deal. Moby Dick sold 3,000 copies throughout his entire life. So this was a major flop. It was not until the existential and spiritual crisis of World War I that critics began to see the value in Moby Dick. It is a futuristic novel written in 1851. From there, it would become a monolith of American and even world literature. Now, despite its initial failure, it is a novel that captures accurately the soul of the American character and the crisis at its core. One year prior to the publication of Moby Dick, America passed the Fugitive Slave Act of 1850. For the first time, the northern states of the United States of America were forced to contend with the problem of slavery. Prior to this, the northerners could often say, "Oh, that slavery thing is a southern problem." A man by the name of Lemuel Shaw was the Supreme Court judge of Massachusetts at this time. He hated slavery. He was an abolitionist. But he loved America as a land of laws, not men. Now, he was the first judge to preside on a case of an escaped slave who had fled a plantation, got all the way to Boston, made it to Boston, was captured, brought before the judge, and Judge Shaw ruled in favor of the law. In other words, this abolitionist took a slave and brought him back to his master. He chose the external law to his internal conscience. There were riots, and he was burned in effigy. Lemuel Shaw was Herman Melville's father-in-law. At the core of this novel is a grappling with both the promise of America and its great failures. The American experiment was alive and flourishing in 1851. The steamboat was opening new regions of land. The railroads was connecting the land from sea to shining sea. 1848 brought the California gold rush. America was preeminent in the production of the prime energy source of that era, whale oil. It seemed everyone was making money and getting richer. The promise that America would be great seemed fulfilled, except some men were slaves to others. In Moby Dick, Ishmael's journey from Nantucket to the Pequod, which is Captain Ahab's ship, serves as a microcosm of America itself. The Pequod's diverse crew, including Queequeg, a cannibal. Who has heard of Queequeg, by the way? Anybody heard the name Queequeg? Just a few? Okay, he's one of the more famous characters in the story. Queequeg, a cannibal from the South Seas. Pip, a young African-American boy. Tashtigo, a Native American man. Dagu, an African. Fadala, a Persian. And Starbuck, a Quaker. These represent the melting pot of American society. Each character in the story brings unique perspectives and backgrounds, reflecting the varied and sometimes conflicting facets of America and America's identity. Now, their collective goal on this ship is to hunt whales for oil under Ahab's obsessive leadership, which mirrors the, I think, united yet troubled spirit of a nation striving for prosperity, sometimes at the cost of moral and ethical dilemmas, such as slavery. The tension between Ahab's monomaniacal quest and Starbuck's voice of reason highlights this internal conflict that defines the American experience. There on the island of Nantucket, and then aboard the Pequod, Herman Melville is able to capture the American character and the conflict at that core. This is the promise, what I'm trying to get at here, is of something grand, a promise of something grand. You come here for a better life, while evading certain spiritual necessities and schisms within the culture. Americans in 1776 decided to shuck off the yoke of their country over just a few taxes to pursue an ideal world in which all men are created equal while maintaining a system of slavery. Americans set out to tame a savage land, only to sometimes become savages themselves. Americans set out on the grand adventure of war in World War I, only to discover there was no point to it but death. Americans set out to destroy evil in World War II, only to ally with another evil, communism. JFK inspired a nation to be the guardians and the policemen of the wrongs in the world, thus leading to America's involvement in Vietnam, a war fought for both the wrong ends and the wrong means. Americans set out on Operation Iraqi Freedom to provide the value of freedom to a people who did not want it or understand it, thus sacrificing the freedom of both the Iraqis and the Americans. This core conflict appears time and again in our society, and Melville, I think, captures it better than almost anyone before Ayn Rand. Now, this is my second reason, Moby Dick. Moby Dick shows us America. Shows us America then and now. To face this is, I think, to face ourselves as Americans on some level. Now, I think it's unfortunate that this book has the reputation that it does. I've talked to people about this all the time, but I think the reputation often causes people to turn away from it before they ever attempt to actually read it. Or worse, having read it in their youth, forever writing it off as a grand epic and too digressive or confusing. All grand things are confusing at first, I think. It takes examination, it takes reflection and time to understand anything grand. This is one of those books that it's worth the time. I believe it's a transformative book for anybody who reads it. Okay, so I'm going to end by reading you a passage. And you guys have been so patient, and I'm going to ask for your patience one more time because it's a confusing passage. But I want you to get a sense of the language, because this is the third reason. I'm not going to go into any more other than the reading of it itself. But this is another really big reason to read this book. I think it's been called a prose epic. And I think there's some truth to that. There's some really fascinating ways that he uses language. And the passage I'm going to be reading, one of the things that I love about it is you can read it, I think, every year and get some new things out of it. It just has a depth to it that's very similar to poetry. Now, I'm going to read from the last paragraph of the chapter called The Whiteness of the Whale. It's a very famous chapter. He goes into all kinds of thoughts and ideas about the science and the culture and what is whiteness, why, what is white as absence or presence of all kinds of a whole, you know, 8 or 9 pages just on what is whiteness and why is the white. And this is how he ends. Now, again, I'm going to ask for your patience because I think there's a lot of confusing things. It's going to be hard, but I hope what it will do is you'll hear a couple pretty phrases, something that might pique your interest. So you'll want to go back and dive into this epic prose story. So here we go. Last paragraph. Is it that by its indefiniteness, it shadows forth the heartless voids and immensities of the universe, and thus stabs us from behind with the thought of annihilation when beholding the white depths of the Milky Way? Or is it that as in essence, whiteness is not so much a color as the visible absence of color, and at the same time, the concrete of all colors? Is it for these reasons that there is such a dumb blankness full of meaning in a wide landscape of snows, a colorless all color of atheism from which we shrink? And when we consider that other theory of the natural philosophers, that all other earthly hues, every stately or lovely emblazoning, the sweet tinges of sunset skies and woods, yea, and the gilded velvets of butterflies, and the butterfly cheeks of young girls, all these are but subtile deceits, not actually inherent in substances, but only laid on from without, so that all deified nature absolutely paints like the harlot, so that all whose allurements cover nothing but the charnel house within. And when we proceed further and consider that the mystical cosmetic, which produces every one of her hues, the great principle of light forever remains white or colorless in itself. And if operating without medium upon matter, which touch all objects, even tulips and roses, with its own blank tinge, pondering all this, the palsied universe lies before us a leper. And like willful travelers in Lapland who refuse to wear colored and coloring glasses upon their eyes, so the wretched infidel gazes himself blind at the monumental white shroud that wraps all the prospect around him. And of all these things, the albino whale was the symbol. Wonder ye then at the fiery hunt. Anybody get anything out of that? I just out of curiosity. You saw what? You see the whale? Okay. So I'm imploring you to not act as the men of the Essex, turning away from this great book out of fear caused by an ignorance. Rather, swim toward the land of knowledge and wisdom. Stretch yourself up, grab onto the hull of the ship, and climb aboard. Thank you. Now, if you have, I didn't know if this would actually elicit any questions, but, oh yeah. Yes. So if anybody would like to join, thank you for that. So January 28th, we're starting Moby Dick. We have, I think, 12 or 13 people signed up, but it's going to be over 4 months. So all you have to read by the 28th is the first 3 chapters. And that's it. So the one Sunday a month. Yeah, so just one Sunday a month for discussion, I think 10:30 a.m. Something like that. But anyway, so yeah, if you'd like to join, let me know. You could definitely join that. It's part of the Literary Canon Club that I have done for a while. This, the 90 minutes. Yeah, so it's online, 90 minutes. It's with people all over the country. And it's people that I've done this for about a year and a half. More like 2 years now. So we've had a group of this for a while. Yeah, so the Literary Canon Club is basically, it's a community and a live discussion group with aides to help keep you motivated. My pitch to people is, if you've ever picked up a great book and put it down without finishing it, this is the book club for you. We'll help keep you on track. We'll help get you going. So there's weekly readings on what you should be reading to stay on track. There's motivation. We try to keep each other accountable. But the idea is to get through some of these books but not kill ourselves doing it, not doing it like a week or two. This is, again, over 4 months. I think it's 600-700 pages, adds up to about 45 pages a week, something like that. So something definitely doable for even a busy professional. So on Zoom. Yeah, it's live on Zoom. Yeah, yeah. Okay, so anything else? Any questions? Who's going to read Moby Dick? One? Two? Okay. But you already planned on doing it. Oh, not you, Marty, but okay. Yes, okay. I did that something. No. So, I mean, I have... I wanted you to that. So that is the end of one of the more philosophical sections. There are amazing characters. There are amazing moments. For instance, you're gonna find moments if you read it. He's gonna teach you about whales. He has a whole section on cetology that he's trying. But he's actually doing something very interesting. You know, people talk about his digressions, but I think there's something real, and he's trying to accomplish something with his digressions. They're not as random as I thought when I first read it. Like, there's a point behind all of it. And so, but he'll go off on like I said, cetology, the history of whaling, how a boat works, how, you know, what the seamen are doing. Here's another small quote. You mind if I read something that's slightly different? This one, I think this is the right one. Yeah. So this one is called Cistern and Buckets. Now it's a chapter about cistern and buckets, random, but it's about actually in detail the process of excavating the oil, the spermaceti, from the head of the whale. And they would he would describe the cutting of the whale, the getting in there with buckets and just hauling this stuff out of there. And a character, Tashtigo, the Native American, falls in to this head, actually. And here's a quote. Now, had Tashtigo perished in that head, it had been a very precious perishing, smothered in the very whitest and daintiest of fragrant spermaceti, coffined, hearsed, and tombed in the secret inner chamber and sanctum sanctorum of the whale. Only one sweeter end can readily be recalled. The delicious death of an Ohio honey hunter who, seeking honey in the crotch of a hollow tree, found such exceeding store of it that, leaning too far over, it sucked him in so that he died embalmed. How many, think ye, have likewise fallen into Plato's honey head and sweetly perished there? So that's like he does that stuff all the time. And sometimes he'll just be straight. Like, he has literally sections that are just almost like a encyclopedia on whales. And it's just, so he has, it's all, it ranges the spectrum of how he writes. And a lot of people criticize that, and I get it. But in the second reading, I'm seeing that there is a purpose behind all of it. Okay. Anything else? Thank you guys for your questions. I hope you guys read that. Okay, nothing else. So I'm going to make one announcement.
I have one more question.
Oh, please ask all the questions.
Herman Melville, an American?
Yeah, he was born, I don't remember where he was born, Massachusetts, I believe. But yeah, 1819, born an American. Again, he was, when he was 19, so he lost, his father lost all their money, or he died and they lost all the family money. He was actually from a well-to-do family. And he had a really good education up till about the age of 11. And then he was out in the system, whatever they did back then. When he was 19, he went on a merchant ship and became a sailor. He did that for about 7 or 8 years, traveling all over the world. He participated in the mutiny. He lived with the cannibals. And then he came back and started writing books, first one being Typee, which is about his sailing adventures and was a big success. And then he wrote another book, Omo, I believe it's called. And then he wrote Moby Dick after, which was actually just about one of his whaling adventures. It was just a straight whaling story, nothing crazy and all the stuff that's in there. A lot of the character Ahab was not in that original story. But then he met a man by the name of Nathaniel Hawthorne. And Nathaniel Hawthorne helped him see that one of his great strengths as a writer was his ability to look at the blackness, the darkness of life, and write honestly about it without being sucked into it. And so he created characters like Ahab, and he added all this depth to the story of Moby Dick. And it became, you know, an enduring classic. So
did he write after that?
He did write after that. He wrote some novels, and I've read a lot of his short stories he wrote after that. So when he died, it was found a copy of Billy Budd, which is probably his other famous story. It's a novella called Billy Budd. My favorite is actually Benito Cereno, but he also wrote The Scrivener, which a lot of people probably read that in high school. Don't even remember it. That's, you know, a guy who says whenever his boss asks him to do something, he says, perhaps I would not, or I would not like to do that, or something like that, or perhaps not. He has like some, you know, it's like he's a broken record type thing. So yeah, he did write, but never really made success in writing. Hopped around a lot. Anything else? Okay. So thank you guys. And here's the announcement. So next month, we're going to have Luke Travers coming back to Austin. He's going to do a talk, and I forget what his talk's about, but it's going to be about basically having a good epistemology helps you in interpreting art. So I think it'll be a really interesting one. This is one that he's done before. He's also going to do a tour in Blanton, and then he's going to do a couple tours up in Houston. So I don't remember the exact date. I think it's around the 18th of February, but the third Thursday. So he's coming for that. He'll be there that whole weekend. If you have not done a Luke Travers tour, I would highly recommend you try it, even if it means going up to Houston. It's definitely, definitely worthwhile. Okay, so thank you everybody for sticking around and checking this out. I hope you read Moby Dick.